Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Gina Radcliffe.
Hello.
You were here last, I believe, for the Haunting of Hill House episode. Is that right?
Right.
Right. Could you reintroduce yourself to everyone out there?
I am the co-host of the Kill by Kill podcast, and I have my own website in which I write about pop culture and old television and movies at GinaRadcliffe.com.
And you were the one who suggested we return to Tennessee Williams with A Streetcar Named Desire, right?
Mm-hmm.
The podcast has done The Glass Menagerie, which is probably the more taught at high school level, but A Streetcar Named Desire holds a really special place in American theater in that I think that people who aren't familiar with this play are familiar with this play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's certain lines in it that sort of become an indelible part of pop culture. It's it probably redefined the for lack of a better phrase, the crazy lady role, because it's so showy and over the top. But yet in a tragic way, you feel like you sort of should find this character pathetic and then you really don't. And yeah, it's definitely a challenging role.
You mentioned there Blanche DuBois, who is one of the great characters of American theater. And of course, the other main character for this play, Stanley Kowalski, who I think people know the character, even if they know nothing about what happened in this play.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of it having been the first major role by Marlon Brando, and Marlon Brando being so damn good looking at the time.
Yeah, it's you hate to find this character attractive because he does have one redeeming quality, is that he's incredibly good looking. But other than that, he's just a brute in every possible way.
This was 1947. It was the play that Tennessee Williams followed up The Glass Menagerie with, and this was the play that, for better or for worse, made Tennessee Williams the most iconic playwright of his generation. It just kind of blew everyone out of the water at the time it came out, for a lot of reasons, mostly because it was seen as so shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's seen as something of a milestone for realism in American theater and for method acting that's associated with the New Group Theater and with Stanislavski and Lee Strasberg, although Brando apparently did not like Strasberg. He worked with Stella Adler.
Mm-hmm.
This is all insider baseball for all you theater nerds out there. Everyone else can tune back in. It occurred to me as I was reading it through this time that it's not an entirely realistic play. And certainly in the staging, it's kind of impressionistic. It's not as experimental as Glass Menagerie was, nor is it yet as experimental as Tennessee Williams would go on to be later in his life. But Williams got this reputation for being a realist from this play. And I think that's part of what screwed him over later in life when he tried to do all the surreal, funky plays that nobody remembers by him.
Right. Like, I think there was one called something about the milk train.
Yeah.
I know that it was made into the legendarily bad movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, that it was just pretty much incomprehensible. And when you look at that, and I think he might have written the script for that too, but if you compare it to like A Streetcar Named Desire, it seems very straightforward, even though a lot of it seems to be in her head and And certainly, you know, that's hard to come across in a theater. Like certainly in the film adaptation, like she's hearing voices and she's flashing back to a different time, and that's harder to illustrate in a live production.
Let's talk a little bit about our history with this play. You suggested this play. What's your background with the play or with the movie adaptation?
Well, I had actually seen the movie first, and then I probably was about 12 or 13, didn't quite understand what was going on in a lot of it. I got the idea of what happened with Blanche and Stanley at the end. I understood that, but I didn't understand what she meant by the fact that, you know, her husband killed himself because he was sensitive, which is, you know, that was actually, they had to say that for the movie because of the, you know, strict guidelines, whereas in the play, no, he's actually gay. I mean, she pretty much, they don't really make any bones about that or use any sort of vernacular. He's gay, and she catches him with another man. He ends up committing suicide over it. But when I was a very dramatic high school and college student, I got on this kick where I read pretty much all of his plays. I read The Glass Menagerie, I read A Streetcar Named Desire, I read Summer and Smoke, which are all the kind of very, you know, everything's really sweaty and passionate, and you know, there's a sort of a boiling undercurrent of, you know, lust, hatred, and madness under all of these plays. And I just really got into these plays and tried to emulate that style of writing, but I just did not do very well in that aspect of it, because it takes a kind of, I would say, the really probably the best at that sort of very, you know, sort of florid style was Tennessee Williams and maybe Truman Capote, but anybody else, it feels a little bit forced and a little precious. But the interesting thing about Tennessee Williams is, I don't know if you ever read any of his collected letters or journals, but even in his personal writing, he wrote almost exactly the way he did in his plays. Like, he just had this very kind of dramatic way of expressing himself, and so this was just the way he wrote.
Yeah, I like what you say there about the way that it can seem very precious for someone else. Williams gets away with a lot of in his writing. When you think about the final speech in Glass Menagerie, it's so incredibly beautiful, but it is such an act of courage to do that on stage, because it's so squishy and difficult to pin down what actually is being said by Tom at the end of that play. This play has a lot more, this play is a lot more grounded in the reality of post-war life in New Orleans, although it slowly devolves into Blanche's overactive imagination at the end of the play. There was a shelf in our basement that was where my dad kept all of his old paperbacks, and this had the cover. This was an old paperback from the 60s that had as its cover the Thomas Hart Benton painting that he did of the poker night scene, which is a remarkable painting, but it makes it very lurid. And I was convinced as a kid that I had found something extremely naughty on my parents' shelf. And so I read it, you know, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. You know, I was aware that there was a playwright named Tennessee Williams, and I was aware of the title, A Streetcar Named Desire. This must have been when I was about 13 or 14, but I certainly didn't know what to expect from the play. Later on in college, I saw a live production of this, one of many thousands of regional productions of Streetcar that goes on every year across this country of ours.
Yeah, it's eternal. I was looking at Wikipedia, and like up till like now, that somewhere in the world there's a production of A Streetcar Named Desire going on.
Yeah, and that was quite eye opening. Partly because when you actually see it staged, you can see how there are a lot of crazy theatrical tricks that are pulled off in the staging. The play as written requires a lot of scrims because you are going from the outside of the apartment to the inside of the apartment to the far courtyard behind the apartment, and that's all being managed by lights turning on and off behind scrims that cause walls to become transparent. And it's quite an interesting play to see produced. With Glass Menagerie, there's a lot of inside and outside to that story. There's what's happening inside the house, and then there's the fire escape that is this sort of a liminal space between the memory of the play and the narration as it's happening now. Similarly, Streetcar keeps moving in depth of a field, but it's more at the service of plot in here than I think necessarily a theme. When they did the movie, of course, they break out of the single location, and I think they kind of lose something, actually, to be honest. When I just watched the movie again for this podcast, and I was a little bit disappointed when there was a scene at the beginning where Blanche actually comes in to this station off a train and asks a local sailor how to get to Elysian Fields, and it sort of ruins the poetry of the introduction of this play, I thought.
Yeah, and it kind of takes away a little bit from just how confined in this little tiny cruddy apartment they are together. And I mean, because there are parts that take place in their downstairs neighbor's apartment, and there's other exterior shots, and it's just it kind of takes away from the claustrophobic aspect of it.
Right. Okay, so probably everyone out there knows this play, but if not, here's a quick summary. A Streetcar Named Desire takes place in New Orleans shortly after the war, where ex-schoolteacher and faded belle Blanche DuBois takes the titular streetcar to visit her pregnant sister Stella. The two were the heirs to a once grand Mississippi estate called Belle Reve, but Stella left to marry the brutish and oversexed Stanley Kowalski. And now Blanche says that the estate has been lost to creditors, and that she has lost her teaching job due to a case of nerves, and needs a place to stay. Blanche projects a delicate, apparently sophisticated demeanor, which rubs Stanley the wrong way. Stanley is also suspicious of the circumstances of Blanche's unemployment, and feels he's been swindled out of Stella's half of the inheritance. At poker night with his pals, Blanche catches the eyes of his friend Mitch, a clumsy, simple man with a sick mother, who listens with sympathy to Blanche's story of how her young husband, not appearing in this play, killed himself when his homosexuality was discovered. Mitch wants to marry Blanche, but it turns out she has a long litany of lovers, including a predilection for teenagers, which Stanley discovers and tells Mitch about. On the night that Stella is to give birth, Mitch calls off the engagement and gets all gross. Worse, Stanley comes home drunk and taunts Blanche as she is starting to lose herself in the fantasy of a former lover coming and taking her away. Then he rapes her. Weeks later, new mother Stella can't let herself believe Blanche's story of the night's events, and Blanche has fallen into a psychosis. A doctor and nurse arrive at the scene to take Blanche to a psych ward while the boys return to poker. So that's the happy ending of Streetcar Named Desire.
Well, you did. I mean, it's not a huge thing. You did leave out that Mitch apparently does show some remorse for his actions because he cries when Blanche is taken away.
No, he Mitch does show some remorse. What doesn't happen in this, which they do put in the plays, Stella ends up just capitulating to Stanley's decision to have Blanche committed.
Yeah, that's definitely something. The character of Stella is probably the one that in the transition from the play to the movie, which I would assume more people are familiar with the movie, but she comes off the most differently. Like I know I went to, we were talking about this before we recorded, I went to an exhibit on the Morgan Library on the writing of Tennessee Williams, and so I got to see some early drafts and some notes on A Streetcar Named Desire and things that he had to change. And basically the takeaway for Stella in the play was, and I'm going to put it in delicate terms, is that she was kind of dick whipped. Basically that, like, you know, she was really just, I mean, they were just, you know, incredibly sexually compatible, and that, you know, the sex was so good that she would go back to him no matter what. And, you know, so again, coming back to what is his redeeming quality? Well, apparently he's really good in bed, and maybe he, you know, brings home a paycheck every couple of weeks. But in the movie, she's a little more independent. Ultimately, she walks. I mean, I don't get the impression that she entirely leaves him, but when Blanche is taken away, she just kind of walks out of their apartment and goes to stay in their neighbor's apartment, which suggests that maybe she's having some second thoughts about staying with him. But in the play, she's just like, yeah, well, you know, what can you do? I got my man. You know, she's not a terribly sympathetic character in the play.
Stella in the play, you know, we can just reduce it all entirely to sex, and I think that in a way that's what you have to do, but she frames it to Blanche as a life of passion, a life alive. You know, if Blanche is still living at home in a what used to be a plantation manor, now greatly reduced in its lands and eventually lost, she thought this was her escape. You know, this was her escape was from gentility to this world of this kind of a tawdry world, a very common and vulgar world. Part of what terrifies Blanche upon arriving at Elysian Fields is the fact that it is racially diverse, that Stanley is Polish, only she uses another word for that, and that she sees it as losing civility and losing civilization. In fact, there's that long speech she gives to Stella about how civilization has progressed and Stanley represents a caveman. The trouble with that is the fact that Blanche herself is given to uncontrollable passion, at least, but in her case, it's more of a kind of a, it's a sort of a neurotic return to try to recapture her husband, who was very young when he shot himself. And who she keeps calling a boy throughout the whole play. She keeps referring to her husband as the boy, and for whose suicide she feels very guilty.
Right, and she's very obsessed with her youth and her appearance. I mean, they're only supposed to be in their 30s, but as far as she's concerned, that's just the end. And she has this special, you know, she insists on having like these shades put on the lamps in her room so you can't see the probably, you know, barely perceptible lines around her eyes, and she's just, you know, that would, you know, if you're flirting and managing to get, you know, very young men to quote unquote date you, you know, that's probably, you know, a pretty effective way of, you know, holding on to your crumbling youth.
There's a lot of ways that you can interpret the conflict between Stanley and Blanche. You know, it's sort of the Old South and the New South. It's sort of the 19th century versus the 20th century, pre-war versus post-war. I was just reading a a little article about how the adaptation to the movie, and apparently when they were adapting it into a film, Warner Brothers did not want there to be an explicit rape in the film. They were very upset by this. And Williams wrote about this. He said, "The rape of Blanche by Stanley is a pivotal, integral truth to the play, without which the play loses its meaning, which is..." And this is very interesting, because almost never do you get an author actually saying this is what this all means. He says, "which is the ravishment of the tender, the sensitive, the delicate, by savage and brutal forces of modern society." And I have to say, I thought that was kind of a pat answer from the author, you know. But for me personally, I always see this play as a commentary on old and new theater. Marlon Brando, who comes along and who makes his career first on the play and then on the movie of this, represents this new method acting, this very mumbly, very animalistic, very interior, psychological kind of acting. And Blanche, who was originally played by Jessica Tandy on Broadway and then by Vivian Leigh in London and, of course, in the film, it represents a kind of an old school theatricality, a very high Shakespearean style of presentational theater. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but there's a point where you mentioned the lamp, and there's a point in the play where Mitch wants to turn the light onto Blanche to see what she actually looks like, and Blanche says, "I don't want realism. I want magic. Yes, magic. I try to give that to people. I misrepresent things to them. I don't tell the truth. I tell what ought to be the truth." And to me, that seems like a real description of that kind of high theater that you associate with British actors. And of course, both Jessica Tandy and Vivian Leigh are British actors portraying Southern Americans.
Yeah, and it's interesting you point that out, and I think that you're absolutely correct in that, like, just their body language, like Marlon Brando basically just comes into it, at least in the movie, just like a gorilla, and whenever he's in Vivian Leigh's presence, she's like shrinking away from him, which is just it's almost like, you know, they never told each other how they were going to. It's like they didn't rehearse. and you know, this was the way she was going to do things, and this is the way he was going to do things, and then you just sort of clash. And there's, like, his reactions to the way she says things. He's just sort of got this smirk on his face. And I mean, you know, on the one hand, that's probably how the character would react to her. But you also kind of get the impression that he just thinks this is funny. Like, the way that she's, like, very mannered in her acting and the kind of very broad, at least with Vivian Leigh, very kind of broad, hammy Southern accent. And she sounds like, it's interesting that, like, she has this very over-the-top Southern accent. And Kim Hunter, who played Stella in both the original play and the movie, doesn't have a Southern accent at all. she's barely trying for one. You know, but with particularly Vivian Leigh, I mean, she kind of, you know, reinforced that whole, "well, I do declare," kind of, you know, Blanche Devereaux sort of, you know, designing women very, you know, we don't know exactly where she's from. We'll just say she's from the South. Picture someone, like, opening up a fan and waving it around. And, you know, wanting some, you know, just a pitcher of sweet tea next to him, just very hammy and Brando is just sort of, like, kind of just smiling. He thinks it's funny.
Well, Brando is also so very mumbly in this play. When you see the movie now, I have no reason to think that this isn't very close to the way he originally presented himself on Broadway, because both the stage production and the movie were directed by Elia Kazan, who is also associated with the New Group Theater, and who kind of made his career on this as well. Actually, I mean, it's interesting. For longtime listeners will know, Elie Kazan directed the original production of The Skin of Our Teeth on Broadway, which starred Tallulah Bankhead. And Tallulah Bankhead was the woman for whom the role of Blanche DuBois was written. That would have been a completely different portrayal, I think.
I think so. For one thing, I think she would have been a little older than Jessica Tandy or Vivian Leroy. I think she would have been. Yeah, but I think it's better to have, you know, the character be in her 30s and really, even by 1947 standards, not that old, and just being delusional about how she's losing her looks and she's no longer appealing to men, and you know, she's embarrassed because maybe she has a tiny line on her face. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, Mitch, when he you know, sees her in full light, and you know, carries on like, you know, like they, when they pull the mask off the elephant man, he's just appalled that this woman who was, you know, evidently about his age should look like a woman his age. and of course the gag is, I mean, he's played by Carl Malden, who really has no room to judge about a person's appearance and how, you know, how old they might look, which is, yeah, but you know, on the other hand, that's typical. You know, I mean, that's typical for a lot of, you know, let's say it, men to have a much higher standard on how a woman should look than they should look themselves.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that is heartbreaking about this story is there's a lot of ways in which Blanche is treated unfairly by life and by society, but it's not as though Williams is making those up. That's unfortunately that is the case for women. It certainly was the case for women then. It's quite frequently the case for women now. The economic situation that Blanche finds herself in is a sad one, as the heir to an ostensible estate, but an estate that no one can keep up. So now she's adrift in the world, and unless she can hook a man, there's just no... there's no way forward for her in this world.
I mean, that's her looks are her only currency.
Right. Now, that one of the things that I also find absolutely hilarious about Stanley Kowalski is that he keeps going on and on about Napoleonic code.
Yeah, it's like he just learned this phrase and he's just going to use it till he's just going to bleed it dry.
I was talking with Shannon, who's doing the reading this time, about this play, and she was mentioning that quite frequently in productions of this play, the audience tends to side with Stanley in some cases against Blanche, which I find just disturbing. And I mean, I for one thing, I don't think that anyone in this play is fully blameless. I don't want to take that away. Blanche is a pedophile, you know, by her actions. Whether she comes to that, you know, naturally or because of the trauma of losing her husband. But what Williams's project always seems to me to be is that he always shows people who are broken, damaged, difficult to like people. And then gets you to kind of think, oh, I understand them better. I sympathize with them. They don't deserve what's happening to them. And I think that's what I always come away from every Tennessee Williams play, is I come away with this feeling that nobody in this play deserved what happened to them.
I mean, is she a little deceitful? Yeah, in a self-preserving sort of way, but you know, he really didn't, that's not his land that he was entitled to. It belongs to his wife, but he really takes it personally that he lost out on this golden ticket of this probably just collapsing southern plantation. And it's just not, you know, it's not, oh, this is, you know, you took this from Stella. It's you took this from me. And it makes it hard to see his point when he does not, I mean, he claims to have Stella's interests in mind, but he doesn't. I mean, one could assume that, you know, if he had gotten a piece of the pie, that he probably would have just ultimately left Stella anyway. But yeah, no, there's, you absolutely should not at any point, you know, see from Stanley's point of view or you know, anybody really. I mean, Blanche is certainly ultimately in the play, at least, she's probably the only truly sympathetic character, whereas in the movie, Stella comes off a little better, and Mitch isn't quite as much of a monster as he is in the play, as it turns out.
Well, I think Mitch is an interesting character because he is very sympathetic, and he is the person that you hang your hopes on if you're an audience member rooting for Blanche to escape her predicament. He seems like a decent guy who is motivated for the right things. He sees Blanche as having come from trauma the way that he himself came from trauma, and it all seems good. But the problem is, the minute Stanley convinces Mitch not just that she got messed up with a student, you know, that was the reason why she lost her job as a teacher, but the fact that she had former lovers, that he finds that unforgivable, and she taunts him about that. You know, he says, well, did you stay at this hotel that has a reputation for, you know, for loose morals and for being a place where prostitutes met their clients? And she said, no, it wasn't that hotel. It was the Hotel Tarantula, and I lured them in like a spider. Which is,
what a great hotel name.
Mitch becomes a horrible, horrible person, and he not only does he not want to marry Blanche, but he feels that he is entitled to her sexually because he holds her sexual past against her, which, you know, is very gross and very disturbing. And everyone out there listening, guys, stop doing that, please.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, he in the movie, I don't think he goes quite so far as to attempt to rape her, but he does not treat her kindly, and he makes some sort of remark about how he would never take her to go meet his sainted mother, who's on her deathbed.
You mentioned before that the movie makes some changes. It does cut out some of the more hot and steamy lines. But it is still pretty dripping with sex for a movie made in 1951.
Oh yeah, I mean, it made a big impression on me when I was a kid and I saw it. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't think, you know, old timey movies were like this.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that they do this incredibly strange thing of taking out the whole motivation for Blanche's husband having shot himself, that the problem is he's overly sensitive and she doesn't respect him for his sensitivity, so he goes and shoots himself. This reminded me of the movie version of The Big Sleep. And if you ever read the novel The Big Sleep, first of all, it makes very little sense, but it at least makes some sense compared to the movie, which makes absolutely no sense. The Big Sleep has the detective Philip Marlowe chasing after one suspect after another in this string of sort of unrelated crimes that just happen to happen one after another. And at one point, the connection between one criminal, one person having killed someone else has to do with a homosexual affair, and they just completely remove that from the story. So there's no motivation whatsoever at that point in the movie. You know, they just leave everything else in. They don't come up with an alternative, and it just it's hilarious if you have read the novel. Strangely enough, that screenplay was written by was written by William Faulkner, who famously called up Raymond Chandler and asked him what happens, and that he said, "I don't understand what's happening in this book," and Raymond Chandler says, "I don't know either." But that was Hollywood in the 50s. You could not really even so much as breathe homosexuality.
Yeah. Like I said, I love that term that he's very sensitive. I you know, before I understood what that meant, I was a little puzzled by, you know, why that would be a bad thing and why she would be, you know, mocking him for that to the point where he commits suicide. Because when I think of someone being, you know, when I think of, you know, a man being described as sensitive, I think of him in terms of that he has, you know, an appreciation for art or poetry or something like that. I'm like, oh, that sounds nice. What would be the problem with that? Like, oh, no, okay, he was into dudes, okay.
You think of a young gentleman addressing a butterfly and saying, exactly. Is this a pigeon?
Yeah, that doesn't sound so bad.
The other thing that this movie does, of course, is the ending, which we've touched on before, which implies that Stella may leave Stanley at the end of the movie, which I think, again, is a mistake. I think that it's an attempt to try and pull some uplift out of the end of this play. And it robs the kind of grace of Blanche's exit. You know, the very famous line, "I have always depended on the kindness of strangers," and the way in which the doctor smiles at her, it's a kind of a nuanced, ambiguous ending. And instead they make it about Stella's personal journey, which I think just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, I would agree with you there, because certainly in the play you just get the impression, you know, particularly that, you know, just ends with you know, Stanley and his buddies at the poker table, you know, and they just go on with their game and you know, just kind of, you know, she's out of the picture and, you know, life is going to continue there as normal. I mean, the only exception to that being Mitch, who is, you know, devastated over seeing Blanche in this condition.
Anything else you want to talk about with the movie? I mean, this definitely was the film that made Brando. It's kind of sad that Jessica Tandy didn't get to play her role, because it would have been an amazing case of the entire cast of a landmark production of Broadway making it to the screen. But Vivian Leigh is very, very good as well. I find it remarkable that she played this role and she played Scarlett O'Hare, and that's what most American moviegoers know her from, are these two roles, in which case it's both these iconic Southern women on either end of the spectrum of the South. But of course, Vivian Leigh herself is English.
Right. Yeah. And that's, yeah, you know, I've never thought of it that way, but that's interesting. They're sort of flip sides of the same character. Like, you know, she's young and she's very, you know, very, you know, steely Southern flower. And then she's kind of, and again, I mean, she's only in her 30s, but, you know, in the decline of her life, she's sort of like this, you know, wilting flower. It's like, you know, what happens if, you know, things didn't work out with Rhett Butler.
We never do get to find out what happens to Scarlett O'Hara at the end of the, you know, it's just, as we say this right now, I realize I've forgotten almost everything that happens in Gone with the Wind. I must have seen, that was one of those movies that was on every year You know, this is the sort of thing that our generation likes to bore millennials with, is talking about how The Wizard of Oz was on once a year. You watched it every time it came on. You know, Gone with the Wind likewise was on once a year, and you would watch it whenever it would come on. And now I can't remember the thing about that movie.
It's such a long movie. it's one of those movies. I don't think I've ever watched it from beginning to end in one sitting, but I've seen it all in parts and just be able to, I've been able to piecemeal it together, but I don't think I've ever watched it from beginning to end at one time. It's very long.
Vivien Leigh did play, Blanche DuBois in the original London production of Streetcar Named Desire, and I was fascinated to find that was directed by Laurence Olivier. So I would be curious to, I need to find some description of that production, because I have a feeling that one was much more highly theatrical.
I'm sure. And I mean, and also, you know, on a putting it on a somewhat of a sad note, she was not mentally well herself, and from what I, you know, from what I've read, this role took a lot out of her. And she really kind of like did not give, you know, as much into, you know, subsequent roles, which there weren't many, I don't think, if memory serves, after she did the movie, but it took a lot out of her emotionally.
That brings up a good point, which is Blanche DuBois remains one of those aspirational roles for actresses to play. She remains, she's sort of like the American Hamlet in a way. I think most stage actresses would dearly love to play Blanche DuBois once in their life, but it is also just a rough part. You're going on a journey with a character who gets utterly destroyed in this play.
I took the blows in my face and body. All of those deaths, the long parade to the graveyard. Father, mother, Margaret, that dreadful weight. So big with it, couldn't be put in a coffin, but had to be burned like rubbish. You just came home in time for the funerals, Stella. And funerals are pretty compared to deaths. Funerals are quiet. Deaths, not always. Sometimes their breathing is hoarse, and sometimes it rattles, and sometimes they even cry out to you, "Don't let me go." Even the old sometimes say, "Don't let me go," as if you were able to stop them. But funerals are quiet, with pretty flowers, and oh, what gorgeous boxes they pack them away in. Unless you were there at the bed when they cried out, "Hold me," you'd never suspect there was a struggle for breath and bleeding. You didn't dream, but I saw. And now you sit here telling me with your eyes that I let the place go. How in hell do you think all that sickness and dying was paid for? Death is expensive, Miss Stella. And old Cousin Jessie's right after Margaret hers. Why, the Grim Reaper had put up his tent on our doorstep. Stella. Belle Reve was his headquarters. Which of them left us a fortune? Which of them left a cent of insurance, even? Only poor Jessie. 100 to pay for her coffin. That was all, Stella. And I, with my pitiful salary at the school... Yes, accuse me. Sit there and stare at me, thinking I let the place go. I let the place go. Where were you? In bed with your Pollock.
Yeah, it's a very physical play. I mean, I can't. I did a little bit of acting in high school, and I did have to do a play once that required me to have to be basically like wrestled around by someone. And you do that a couple nights in a row, and it's like, okay, I'm done with this. But I mean, if you're talking, you know, 4 or 5 nights, you know, a week for months, I just can't even imagine what that kind of does to your spirit and your body for after a while. Just, you know, just you know, this actor, you know, probably good 6 to 7 inches taller than you and outweigh you by 50 pounds, just kind of tossing you around like a rag doll. And I don't imagine that Marlon Brando is particularly delicate about doing that.
You know, I've always loved this play and I've always loved the movie, but you know, in recent years, a lot has come out about Marlon Brando, and particularly about the production of Last Tango in Paris, which right. makes me think that he may not have had the most concern for the well-being of his fellow actors, and this is one of those things that has long been a criticism of method acting, is that people who become really obsessed with this idea of interior life and of finding truth in, you're supposed to substitute emotions on that the character is having for emotions you're remembering, and it can trigger just really violent productions and really just strong, powerful emotions. It can be mesmerizing to watch. It can also just be brutal to actors, not just the actor performing it, but the actor who has to put up with you performing it.
Oh, yeah. And I actually double checked because I wanted to make a point to that. Marlon Brando did not play Stanley in the London production. It was someone with the hilarious name of Bonar Caliano, which would have been interesting if it had been Brando, if Laurence Olivier directed, because Laurence Olivier was not a fan of method acting. I think it was Dustin Hoffman when Dustin Hoffman talked about being a method actor or something, like getting into character, Laurence Olivier says something like, well, it's just called acting. So I don't imagine that, particularly if this was his spouse at the time, that he would have been too into seeing him tossing her around and you know, being very rough with her. I don't think that would have gone too well. So it's probably a good thing that Brando, you know, either did not want to fly over to London or was not invited to play the role in that production.
As I said when we started here, I think that a lot of people have the basic image of Stanley Kowalski and Blanche DuBois in their heads, even if they don't really know the plot line of the story. And because Brando went on to become such an iconic figure, people like to do the Stella line from this, which is, to be fair, that's a scene that takes place after he's beaten his wife and she's, you know, hiding away with a neighbor, refusing to come, and he's just shouting at her until she gives in and comes down. Now, I suppose one could read that as like, oh, he's just such an animal. He's got such magnetism. She can't help herself, and see something twistedly beautiful about that. But, you know, to me, it's just a disturbing sequence.
Yeah, it's the same bad read that people apply to when people used to think that Every Breath You Take was a love song. You know, it's like, I mean, I guess if you really want to twist it around, it could be perceived as romantic, but he's an animal and he's a child, and the only way he knows how to get what he wants is to, you know, literally scream and throw a tantrum about it. Right.
Or the people who see Tyler Durden as some sort of a hero.
Exactly. It's like, this is a very bad take on this.
Reading it through this time, you mentioned to me that you were really struck by the differences in the play and the movie. Reading it through this time, how are you coming away with your opinion of the play?
Well, I feel the play is you a little more pragmatic, particularly in terms of, like I said before, you know, she's taken away and then life goes on. I mean, what's Stella supposed to do? She has a baby, she has a husband, you know, it's not like she can just, you know, up and leave and go take care of her sister or go see what's going on with Belle Reve. I mean, that part of her life is over and she's happy with that. And I think, I, this may seem to be an odd comparison, but in rereading the themes of the play, I thought a lot about the movie Young Adult in terms of a character having a very hard time accepting that someone could be happy and fulfilled in a life that does not seem appealing. You know, Stella is happy in her cruddy little apartment with her gorilla of a husband, or if she's not happy, she's doing a great job of making it look like she is, but she doesn't aspire to have more than that. That's what she wants. You know, she, you know, wants this guy and a baby with this guy and this little apartment, and, you know, Blanche can't see that or accept that. And Stella ultimately resents her for that, which it does come through a little bit through in the movie more than it does in the play. I feel that in the movie, Stella, you know, definitely feels more tenderness towards Blanche, which that doesn't always seem to be too present in the play. I think that she kind of only thinks of her only slightly less of an inconvenience than Stanley does.
One of the things that I was fascinated reading this through as a play, as literature rather than something that you see on the stage, is there is a sequence late in the play where first when Mitch is over and Blanche is breaking down and Mitch is breaking things off with her, where she overhears in the courtyard beyond the house a Mexican woman offering flowers for the dead, or flores para los muertos. And the thing about that is, if you see this produced, it becomes a very strange and very surreal part of the play. It gets a call back a little bit later when Blanche is trying to run out of the house where Stanley is, and it's supposed to kind of reflect the fact that she still can't confront the fact that her husband is dead. She doesn't want to go out into the world because it scares her. She doesn't want to confront the reality of mortality. But when you read it in the play, it's just like two lines or something in the play, in the script, and it would be very easy to like skip over. You know, and I think that this is one of those things where, you know, when you're a kid, especially reading plays in class, you just never think about staging,
right?
And you would just, I think that they would that would not stick out as particularly even notable at all from reading this script. Whereas I think if you see it produced, it's one of the most arresting parts of the play.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out that scene was parodied in the movie Quick Change, where they get lost. I think they're in Queens, and of course this was like I think the early late 80s when this movie came out. So of course anything outside of Manhattan was incredibly scary and desolate and dangerous, and they're lost, and there's just this old lady going around yelling Flores, Flores para los muertos, and literally to this day, every time I am, you know, even mildly lost somewhere, I just say it to myself. And it's just, I don't know if I picked it up from that or from A Streetcar Named Desire, but the two are intricately linked for me because of that. You know, I was going to mention how, you know, a lot of, you know, how there's been, you know, different theatrical versions, you know, played by, I think, Jessica Lange did it for the theater with, I want to say, Alec Baldwin.
Yes, which, that, right. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, and John Goodman as Mitch, which would have been an interesting, which, and then there was one where it was James Gandolfini playing Mitch. It was a very, I would say that the casting of, you know, Mitch in recent years has been more interesting than the kind of, you know, this sort of, you know, you kind of schlubby, verging on middle-aged guy, which again makes the whole, much like Carl Malden, you know, which again makes the whole, you know, his shock at what she quote unquote really looks like, you know, kind of, you know, I guess ironic would be the word for it. Just, you know, dude, who are you to be criticizing her for the way she looks? But I think Cate Blanchett did the role some years ago. It's, you know, it's, do you have like a dream cast to do this?
I can imagine a lot of good Blanches, but Stanley, it's so hard for me to pull Stanley away from Marlon Brando. When I was reading about the initial staging of this, one thing that the two things struck me. One was apparently when Tennessee Williams saw Marlon Brando, he called him the best looking man he had ever seen. And it's kind of obvious that Williams himself fell in love with Brando in a way. And secondly, that Kowalski, when he was originally written, was supposed to be in his late 40s. He was supposed to be a much older guy. And Brando comes in, plays him, you know, much younger and much more, you know, in shape and together. And that completely changes the way that that character reads. So I guess my answer to casting Stanley would have to be you can't really out Brando, so you'd have to go a completely different direction with him somehow.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't even really any current actress who even kind of have his physicality, where he kind of looks like a handsome shaved gorilla. that's the best way I can describe him. And that's not a look that's really in right now, for lack of a better term. I mean, like I mean obviously most young, you know, into their 30s actors are well built, but they're not like hulking like Marlon Brando is. So I honestly can't think of anybody that I would describe it. I mean, of course, obviously, you know, you could put on weight, you could get, you know, super buff, but I just really, there's no one I can think of that comes to mind that would be that suitable for it.
I think for Blanche, I would have loved to see Laura Dern play her.
That would have been great.
Maybe about 10 years ago. I think at this point, she's just a little too old for the role. Yeah. But that would have been pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think now maybe keeping with the theme of having British actors play her, I think maybe Emily Blunt would be good at it. I would say like maybe an Amy Adams would be good for Stella, and we can bring back Philip Seymour Hoffman from the dead to play Mitch, God rest his soul. He would have been great at Mitch. He would have been amazing as Mitch. God rest his soul.
Thanks to my co-host, Gina Radcliffe.
Oh, thank you.
Her podcast is the Kill by Kill podcast. Thanks to the reading goes to Shannon Camp. Her podcast is Stage of Fools. I'm so giggly right now. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Keep up the reading, everybody. And remember, everything will be on the final.